This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of A Funeral for Psychoanalysis, undertaken by Jameson Webster. The event took place on January 13th, 2012, in commemoration of her recent book, The Life and Death of Psychoanalysis.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank you for coming out tonight on this somber occasion. You all look very lovely. For many of you, there may be a sense of relief. This has been an event too long anticipated, too many times foretold. You've been in the grip of an anxious wait. This funeral finally gives you permission to mourn the loss of your beloved. For others, this may have come as a shock, and for that I am sorry to be the bearer of this sad news. You never thought this time would come. We should take our lesson from Freud. Death makes life more valuable, and only when it can be truly risked can it take on its highest stakes in the game of living. It was a real love affair. But your desire need not be buried with psychoanalysis tonight. And in light of this, we should not leave out the fact that for others, this funeral may be a cause for celebration. If psychoanalysis has wronged you, if it has left you aggrieved, failed to follow through on its promises, now is the time to lay down your swords. Hate, as love, only follows on the heels of our most secret hopes. Death, like an unforeseen encounter, enlivens us as the squeaking wheel of disappointment slows and comes to a halt. Lacan thought that we should change Kant's question, "What may I hope for?" to "From where do you hope?" He was always making these little displacements, showing us the difference between an object of desire, always more on the side of death, and desire itself, imminently closer to life. A corpse, it must be said, was the model of all objects for Lacan, if only because in the face of it, in the face of absolute materiality, corporeality, and the thingliness of a thing, do we realize what had animated it? Always, only, and ever desire. We could have imagined that psychoanalysis would have taken on the purity of this relationship between desire and the dead, a play of reversals between patient and analyst, where the analyst, in their deathly silence, marks the sheer creation on the part of a patient. But alas, it seems that psychoanalysis forgot that it was only supposed to play dead. For myself, I would like to give back to you this question, from where do you hope? For with it tonight, next to the body of our loved one, we take flight. Tonight, we mourn the loss of psychoanalysis. We will hear eulogies tonight reminding us how marvelous, how marvelously strange, and how strangely problematic was this great beast. First, we will hear from Hari Kunzru, author of many revered novels that I think of as fundamentally about landscapes and love. I have sometimes imagined Hari as a fierce psychoanalyst because of his sheer love of the word. But he was too good, and we are happy that we didn't keep him bound to a sinking chair in silence.
And so, farewell, psychoanalysis. Your final hour has come. There will be no session next week. When the death pangs started, we didn't know whether to call for a doctor or a priest. Finally, we phoned a stand-up comedian. He said he'd been seeing an analyst for 15 years. 15 years? We were shocked. Yeah, he said, I'm going to give him another year, and then I'm going to Lourdes. That's just how the intellectual world ends. Not with a bang, but a diminution, a slide into folk religion. You sailed up the East River on board a ship. You thought you'd be unwelcome. Ratman bringing the plague. Dora the Explorer. You came here to get famous, which you did in spades. In return, what did you get up to? You shrunk people. Song of myself turned into Portnoy's complaint. Sung repetitively in Midtown treatment suites. You were very stern at first. You said America was the anti-paradise, a giant mistake. But as it turned out, that was just your symptom speaking. Sure, America was hell on earth. The noise, the people. So hard to get a good slice of Sachertorte. But America loved you. Sure, it was partly your European accent, but they only made so many jokes because they took you seriously. You told America that sexual feelings couldn't be repressed without consequences. It was the greatest idea ever. It was the hula hoop of theory, what everyone had been waiting for years. It had everything. It was revolutionary, 1776 all over again. Every time two people had a zipless fuck, it was one in the eye for King George. For a while, it seemed like you had the whole repression thing beat. Orgasms for all. And now, we have AIDS and Rick Santorum. Guilt is back in fashion, bundled up in its sweater vest, reeking of surreptitious nocturnal emissions. Is that what killed you? Were the forces of reaction just too strong? Or did you get your hat handed to you by a bunch of good old boys you thought were too dumb to fight back against your fancy European notions? Maybe that's what happened. While you thought you were teaching them to know themselves, they hollowed you out, turned you into lifestyle. You were always mixed up with that masturbatory old Protestant habit of self-examination. Maybe, said the good old boys, you were just another kind of spiritual autobiography. An analysis was no different from looking into your soul and finding the Lord. And maybe you were just another kind of shopping, part of everyone's God-given right to choose. As we tried to revive you, the comedian told us that last year he had difficulty with his income tax. He tried to take his analyst off as a business deduction. The government said it was entertainment. Finally, they compromised and made it a religious contribution. We put coins on your eyes and lowered you into your coffin. We're already nostalgic. Nostalgic for the subconscious, for the privacy that implies. Now we're all on Facebook, under constant surveillance. We have cameras in every orifice. Already, we miss you.
We will now hear from Lisa Weinstein, psychoanalyst, writer, professor, and the prodigal child of the heyday of American psychoanalysis in New York. She knows it better than anyone, and she has taught me that to have known psychoanalysis is to know it in its most deathly forms. She is the consummate Freudian. She is the widow of psychoanalysis.
I'm wearing the dress I married you in.
Oh, what's that, you say? We weren't married? How petty you've become after all these years. You've forgotten your own ideas. Need I remind you? There's no in the unconscious. And all thought begins in desire. Well, I'll begin again. I'm wearing the dress I married you in. Oh, all right. I was your mistress. You've gotten so moralistic, you probably think I shouldn't even be talking at your funeral, hoping I'd hide in the back, veil over my face, others asking, who is she? Who is she? Well, no one understands being faithful like a mistress. I was a devout leaf, believed utterly in the tree, ignorant of the coming autumn. How I loved you. Worshipped your absence that forced me to create you over and over, search for you day after day, year after year, lying on couches up and down Park Avenue, reading horrific prose in leather-bound journals. I believed in the unconscious and thought I'd never grow old. But look at me, I've shrunk the arse of an old elephant, and still I'm searching. Still you elude me. You're probably not even in that coffin. Birth was the death of him. Did you write that? Well, you should have. From the first hysteric reminiscence, your death was ascending, a patient seducer. A lapping wave whose gentle kisses erode the sandcastle.
one to whom you long to submit. I have to say, death becomes you. There wasn't much left anyway. Face it, you were done, a dried-up old prince, reminiscing in an outmoded castle, strutting around in your tarnished armor. The world's passed you by. It's a world of initials, DBT, CBT, EMD, TFP, MBT, IPT, a world of representation without symbol. No one believes in you anymore. And those that did, even worse. They made movies about you, bad movies, as if a riding crop slap on the bottom was all you were about. It's humiliating. But why am I sorry? You betrayed me, seduced by those bitches who turned your beautiful irreverence into a church of sniveling good-heartedness, turned my vagina into a nether mouth, refound a moral order. Well, I say, let us romp through the devastation, pick over the corpse. Let's set it on fire, ashes to ashes. Watch the carbon fumes in their endless binding permutations, a chemical eros. I'll strike the first match. Oh, what's the use? I'll never be rid of you. What did you say about the shadow of the object? I can never see a train rushing through a tunnel without thinking of you, or wonder why I don't feel able to drive a stick shift. I'll never be rid of you. Open that coffin, and you'll find the maggots wriggling in baby joy of their new beginning. I'll never be rid of you. I'm still wearing the dress I married you in.
We will now hear from David Lichtenstein, psychoanalyst, writer, editor, and in general, someone who has gracefully navigated the Freud wars like the skillful tacking of a ship in stormy seas. David's gaze is fixed on the horizon as if armed with Freud's message from the dream after his father's funeral, always with one eye closed.
We come to bury, not to praise. This is as it should be for the children of Oedipus. And what are we if not the living children of Oedipus? I ask you to recall the unfortunate death of three children of the tragic king and how their fate was tied to the rites of burial. Their story makes it clear that mute death is not as important for the living as is the matter of the funeral. Indeed, it is only the funeral rite and the obsequies that command us to follow that render death a fit subject for the living. Remember how Oedipus set his two sons up in an impossible profession. They were to rule together as kings, taking turns in what might be called a relational manner. Of course, being relations, one refused, the other attacked him for it, and they both ended up dead, although not both buried. It fell to a third child, a daughter of Oedipus, to see to the burial of the one that was judged guilty by the forces of law and order. As a scandal and deemed a traitor, this brother was to be denied a funeral. His sister sacrificed herself by insisting on his proper rights and obsequies in defiance of those forces of law and order that had denied them. She was sentenced to be buried alive and thus attended her own funeral. Did that daughter of Oedipus simply take the side of a traitorous, violent brother, and use that cause as a justification for her own wish to defy the forces of order, forces she sought to defy because they denied her power and majesty? Or did she instead take the side of grace and honor in the face of murderous acts and the willful denial of truth, and submit to the dictates of grace, even to the point of our own sacrifice. It's left to us, the living children of Oedipus, to decide. But of these three tragic children of Oedipus, whose psychoanalysis do we come to bury here tonight? The psychoanalysis of Eteocles, that once finding itself installed in the position of power, refuses to relinquish it, and thereby refuses to follow the impossible and fundamental rule by which that power was created? The psychoanalysis of Polynices, that insists on following the principle of its own creation, even though it leads to death and self-destruction? Or indeed, the psychoanalysis of Antigone, that merely insists on the proper rites to mark its fated demise? And if it be the psychoanalysis of Antigone that we come to bury here tonight, then is it the Antigone of defiance or the Antigone of grace? The living daughter of Oedipus, who invited us here tonight for this funeral, has suggested an answer. Of Antigone, she wrote, quote, "She puts herself beyond fear, beyond pity, and the boundary point for her is always that between life and death. Her object is the still living corpse. Antigone, in pushing towards this limit, embodies the potential virtues of the analyst." End quote. To mark a death is neither to be its cause nor its champion. It is to submit obsequiously and gracefully as the subject of both Thanatos and Eros, so another child of Oedipus once put it. Submission to the funeral rite and the loss of power and authority that it entails is the necessary condition for psychoanalysis to begin. To refuse the rites of burial is instead to take Creon's place as the guarantor of law and order. We children of Oedipus occupy that limit zone between life and death, represented by the weeping rock of Niobe. It is neither by clinging to life nor by playing dead that we carry on, but rather by pursuing the impossible object that is the living corpse.
We will now hear from George Prochnik. George wrote this extraordinary story on Freud in America in his book Putnam Camp, Sigmund Freud, James Jackson Putnam, and the Purpose of American Psychology. I was surprised to find out that his next book was In Pursuit of Silence, where he asks about the relationship we hold to silence and noise. What did you find, George, in this story of Freud in America that brought you to the question of silence? My fantasy is that psychoanalysis in America told you something important about death.
Thank you for asking that, Jameson. In preparing my remarks, I found myself pondering a question that I'm sure has come into the minds of many of us in this room. What exactly are we doing here? What are we mourning or celebrating the passing of? And in the course of thinking about this problem, I've found myself drifting back to a couple of winters ago when I was in a Trappist monastery in Dubuque, Iowa. It snowed all the time, and when you walked outside, even when it wasn't snowing, 6 feet in front of your face, sky and ground blended into one solid mass of whiteness. Even though the Trappists don't talk very much and are encouraged to talk less than they actually do, one of the monks in this particular monastery, Brother Alberic, had been given a special dispensation to spend time with me and really to chat. We spent a lot of time in a window staring out at the snow in the refectory, kind of glumly gabbing, mostly about silence, regarding which Alberic had a number of very provocative theories, among them that the so-called highway of death in Iraq was actually a product of the exposure of thousands and thousands of American troops who'd been sitting in the desert for weeks prior to that, to more silence than they'd ever had in their lives. He said to me that the generals didn't like the fact that they were beginning to have a monastic experience and sort of set them loose on Highway 80. And the resulting carnage he saw as directly triggered by a new experience of silence. But after a while, I think Alberic began to feel guilty about the fact that, in fact, although I'd come to this monastery to experience silence, I'd had very little of it, largely because he'd been talking so much. And a lot of what he spoke about was a chapel in the base of this monastery where outsiders weren't permitted to go. It was only for the brothers. It was a frightening place, he said, a dark, silent place. And one or two occasions, and over the many years he'd been there, he'd in fact taken outsiders there, and he said that one person from New York had actually had kind of a hysterical fit after being in the space for a few minutes. So of course I wanted to go. We descended miles of dim corridors, stairways. There were torches. There was less and less light. We at last went into this small room, oddly decorated, a shrine. There was one other monk in there at the time, a very large, bearded man who was sitting with his legs spread wide, his head slightly bowed, and just... that was the only sound. I didn't freak out. But I did begin to have this feeling of deja vu, and I couldn't place what this was about. And suddenly, it struck me, my God, that brother on the chair across the room from me looks exactly like my ex-girlfriend psychoanalyst. And in fact, this whole chamber into which we'd gone looked exactly like the Upper East Side office which he worked out of, where I'd once improbably been drawn into. If you could just transform that image of the Virgin into a certificate from the New York Psychoanalytic Institute, if you could metamorphose the crucifix into a faience amulet of the Isis-headed god Thoth, it was uncanny. But after a time, Alberic signaled to me that we had to go, and when we were walking away, after making me feel very smug about how well I'd done in this space, we got back upstairs, and he began talking to me about why this particular chapel was really a distillation of the whole monastic experience. He said it involved cultivating silence, solitude, and darkness. Silence, solitude, and darkness. Where had I heard that particular triangle of words before? And then I remembered this moment in Freud's essay, The Uncanny, when he speaks of those being the foundational experiences of, or triggers to the infantile anxiety, which we never quite outgrow. And indeed, you might say they're kind of the pillars of what we mature neurotics work with for the rest of our lives. But why should it be that there would be these parallels between the space of monastic meditation and the room in which analysis takes place? Alberic, in explaining to me what he was trying to do, talked about how all the brothers in this monastery were involved in a process of preparing for death. And I think one way to begin articulating what's going on in this funeral, what we're commemorating the loss of, is to think about it perhaps as a tool for preemptively commemorating the loss of ourselves in a secular sense. I think it's fair to say, with all of the religious inflections, it was a secular way of beginning to, as the filmmaker Andrei Tarkovsky once said about the purpose of art, harrow the soul in preparation for death. When I think about Freud and death, I think about him passing out at a lunch with Jung in the Park Hotel in Munich in 1912 and waking up in the arms of that great Swissman, saying how sweet it must be to die. Certainly for Freud himself, death was a consummation most devoutly to be wished. And I don't think he would have been particularly bothered by two famous quips from Karl Kraus about analysis, one of which he said, psychoanalysis is as useful as careful directions on a box of deadly poison. and another one in which he said, God made man out of dust. Psychoanalysis returns him to it. I come back to what for me is the weirdest speculation in the whole of Freud's canon. And it's in Beyond the Pleasure Principle. But it's not when Freud says that the purpose of all life is death. That's one thing. It's when he's trying to wrestle with the problem of if this really is the end that we all so devoutly wish, why we don't all run out and kill ourselves, why anything exists at all. And he says that ultimately, instinctual life as a whole is geared towards bringing about, since instinctual life is geared towards bringing about death, the theoretical importance of the instincts of self-preservation, self-assertion, and mastery greatly diminish. They are component instincts whose function is to assure that the organism shall follow its own path to death and to ward off any possible ways of returning to inorganic existence other than those which are imminent in the organism itself. What we are left with is the fact that the organism wishes to die only in its own fashion. So learning to die, in fact, becomes a process of articulating our individuality. And in this sense, we might say that if psychoanalysis really has successfully died, it's only managed to die by consummating what is truly individual and distinctive in its identity. We might also say that if it is, in the words of the coroner of Oz, the case that psychoanalysis is not only merely dead, but really most sincerely dead, then what has in fact passed with it is not just a secular route to preparing for death, but a certain vision for attaining individuality, a framework for, as Alberic said to me of silence, bumping into ourselves. The issue then becomes now, not what we have lost, but what is doing the work of psychoanalysis today? What have we put in its stead? Perhaps in place of silence, solitude, and darkness, we might say noise, the crowd, the permalight of the new security surveillance, self-YouTubing state. But Freud, to his credit, balked at the nostalgic perspective. In fact, the analytic project was dedicated, arguably, to combating this, and his saying that hysterics suffer from reminiscences, and in many ways defining the project as eliminating an overly commemorative relationship to death is what Freud was all about. So, no pity. At one moment, in a letter to Jung, Freud remarked, he was beginning to grouse a bit about a bout of ill health. He said, old age is not a delusion. A morose cynic deserves to be shot without remorse. I think my vote for an epitaph on the tomb we're building is one long sentence from Civilization and Its Discontents. Freud said there, one thing only do I know for certain. That is that man's judgments of value follow directly on his wishes for happiness. That accordingly, they are an attempt to support his illusions with arguments. Thank you.
Ezra Feinberg is a psychoanalyst and writer whose work always seems to touch on humor, unseriousness, and play, knowing that what is serious shares its most intimate edge with these others. Ezra's words will no doubt be a moment of relief on this dark day.
Hi, Mr. Psychoanalysis. Hi, I'm Dr. Feinberg. Come on in. So, what brings you here? Wow. Well, it really sounds like you've been through a lot. Tell me, how long have you been feeling this way? Oh, well. Sounds like you've really been suffering for quite some time. It sounds to me as if you feel the whole world is against you. The whole world is against you. Uh-huh, okay. Yes, it certainly does sound like it feels very real to you. It is real. It is real. Huh. I wonder if it's important for you to feel that I believe you when you say that in actuality the whole world is completely against you. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Well, in your view, was it always this way? Uh-huh. Well, I wonder, too, if what feels like these powerful forces conspiring against you may incite a certain sadness along with this rage that you describe. Okay, just rage. Got it. Okay. Uh-huh. I guess I'm wondering, at the risk of harping a bit, if you feel a sense of loss around what sound like feelings of intense anger. Just anger. Okay. Well, it sounds as though your father really put quite a bit of pressure on you to remain loyal to his vision. Uh-huh. Well, I wonder if when you say that you feel your father was a tyrannical asshole who thought he was some kind of master of all minds, who was all-knowing, perhaps you feel it's important that you be all-knowing as well, that you be a master as well. Uh-huh. Well, that sounds like a lot to carry around. Well, I certainly don't claim to be a master. I mean, I do. Who am I? Well, who am I to think I know anything about you? That's a good question. Well, I wonder if you might be fearful that I might not understand you. Uh-huh. Well, I wonder if in telling me to go fuck myself, perhaps there's a way in which you might be feeling like, hey, who is this guy? Uh-huh. Well, is it possible that when you say that that actually I couldn't fuck myself because I am, as you say, completely dickless, that you might have those kinds of feelings about someone else? Well, tell me, what might my being dickless mean to you? That I have no penis. Okay. Well, it sounds like you might be having some difficult feelings about being here and opening up. Fuck me. Oh, okay. Well, it seems like now you're really kind of bringing this rage into the room, and I'd like to hear more about that. But we're going to need to stop.
Patricia Garavici is an esteemed Lacanian psychoanalyst and writer, and she has always told me that since she lived through the crisis in Argentina, she can live through the crisis of psychoanalysis. But, she qualified, I'll change its name, not psychoanalysis, the practice of the unconscious, a practice close to this radical act of renaming. Maybe Patricia tonight can also be the birth of a new signifier.
When Jameson invited me to the funeral for psychoanalysis, the first question I asked myself was, what or whom are we actually burying tonight in 2012? Many years ago, when I left my native Argentina, to be precise, in 1989, my Villa Freud Lacanian analyst warned me, forget the idea of practicing as an analyst in the US. Their psychoanalysis has long been dead. It has been killed decades ago. With this ominous piece of advice, I arrived in the US in the early days of the 1990s so-called Freud Wars. In November of 1993, and you have a slide, Time magazine asked aloud, on its cover, no less, but with a delay of 54 years, is Freud dead? And the former analytic strongholds, like the New York Review of Books, published lengthy articles debunking Freud's reputation as a man and as a thinker. Calls to bury Freud proceeded everywhere. But my practice as an analyst in North Philadelphia's barrio was pointing to a very different situation. They are in the barrio clinic where I practice, the Anitas, Margaritas, Socorros, Josés, with their ataque de nervios or hysteric symptoms of yesteryear, were showing me that psychoanalysis was not only needed but reinvented every day in the ghetto. Perhaps the key to what or whom is buried here tonight is to be found in the first Time magazine cover with Freud in it, and this one dates from October 27, 1924. Under the heading Freud and Freudianism, the magazine's central feature offered a glowing review of the recent publication in English of Freud's Beyond the Pleasure Principle and Group Psychology and the Analysis of the Ego. I will give you a brief quote. "The science of psychoanalysis, as Freud explains it, is so logical in appearance that the gravest error may be in accepting its conclusion as great and devastating truth. One and one, the world is convinced, make two. But add one bad man to one good woman, and the critics will argue forever on the sum. The fact is that psychoanalysis is a scientific method which, before it can be more generally accepted, will have to wait until much more water has flowed under London Bridge." End of the quote. As for the person of Freud, the article covered basic biographical data, and for character description, it relied on Fritz Bittel's word, who saw Freud as, quote, "an emperor, one around whom legends begin to accrete, who holds enlightened but absolute sway in his realm and is animated by a rigid sense of duty. He has become a despot and who will not tolerate the slightest deviation from his doctrine, holds councils behind closed doors and tries to ensure by a sort of pragmatic sanction that the whole body of psychoanalytical teaching shall remain an indivisible whole." End of the quote. The article also mentions that Freud once referred to himself as, quote, "the only rogue in a company of immaculate rascals." Since funerals have to do with expiration dates, which is to say with duration, in order to learn a little more about the man and the movement he founded, I will stick to Time magazine. Freud was for the second time on the cover of Time in 1939, but not after his death, but just 3 months before, in June of 39. The central story was dedicated to psychoanalysis, by now labeled as a medical subspecialty, since the title was Medicine Intellectual Provocateur. Freud is described as, and I quote again, "the greatest killjoy in the history of human thought, transforming man's jokes and gentle pleasures into dreary and mysterious repressions, discovering hatreds at the root of love, malice at the heart of tenderness, incest in filial affections, guilt in generosity, and the repressed hatred of one's father as a normal human inheritance." The specific book discussed, as many of you may have guessed, was Moses and Monotheism and its scandalous thesis. Moses, the founder of the Jewish religion, was not a Jew, but an Egyptian. To add insult to injury, according to Freud, the Jews had killed Egyptian Moses. Thanks to this assassination, his memory persisted, like the father seen by children, a stern, implacable, good, effective. When Freud appeared again in Time's cover, it was on April of 1956, and this was to celebrate the centenary of the birth of the so-called medicine explorer, like William Drake and so on. And the 1956 article said, quote, "no day of eulogy is needed. However, to dramatize the legacy of Sigmund Freud to his generation and generations to come, Christianity brought to Western civilization the conviction that man is governed by his God through his deathless soul, along came the Renaissance and then the 18th century rationalists to counter his doctrine with another faith. Man is responsible to reason alone. There is no God, no immortal soul. Then came Sigmund Freud to champion the newer hypothesis. Man without a God is largely governed by a strange, little-known power called the unconscious, end quote. The article also mentions that in 1952, which is precisely the year when the diagnosis of hysteria was officially eliminated from the psychiatric nomenclature, that the bulletin of the Catholic clergy of Rome had declared, quote, "It is difficult to consider free of mortal sin anyone who uses psychoanalysis." Forthwith, Pope Pius XII took pains to correct the bulletin and added that with a certain stiff reservation, for instance, no encouragement of the idea that they can be seen without subjective guilt, psychoanalysis is a legitimate method of treatment. In the following years, Freud was the subject of many articles, some giving him a new professional title, like the Great Psychiatrist, that in 1955. And by 1979, his specialty was restricted to behavior, and the question was, did Freud build his own legend? Freud did not get another cover until 1993, which is the one we saw first, when the magazine asked whether or not he was dead. But he put him in 1999, which was, by the way, the real centenary of the interpretation of dreams. And there we see Freud on his chair, taking notes on what looks like a mystic writing pad, and he's facing Einstein. But as you may observe, they are face to face. So we see psychoanalysis is no longer taking place. Freud was part of the American century, but he was reduced to a cultural phenomenon. It did not matter if he was a thinker or a tinker. He was a star. I mean, the celebration was a funeral whiff of defeat. The psychoanalytic century was over before the 21st century had begun. Everyone seemed to know the answers to Time's rhetorical question. Psychoanalysis was indeed dead. Well, by Freud, like the Ratzmann's father, seemed quite powerful and somehow still alive, killed over and over again in cyclical magazine covers that kept him frozen in a spectral status, haunting the living. Paradoxically, the power of Freud seems stronger for its critics than for its followers. I'm tempted to rephrase Time's rhetorical question, is Freud dead yet? At last, we are in a position to do justice to Freud and to psychoanalysis. If some people aren't ready to celebrate the death of Freud, we are. As we know, a movement can really begin when its founder dies. Let's bury Freud and thus give up on the temptation of endless rattling of skeleton in the psychoanalytic closet. Let us not repeat another hysterical childbirth, another unrevealed truth exposed, and instead mourn once and for all the stillborn child of psychoanalysis, Anna's Oz, imaginary baby, Dr. B's child, as she called it. Let us accept the logical termination of a phantom pregnancy. Freud is not the surrogate father of an orphan institution, but the creator of a practice that's still alive, as we can attest in the everyday reverberations of the unconscious echoing from the couch. The founder of psychoanalysis is dead. Long live psychoanalysis.
Ben Kafka is a historian, psychoanalyst, professor, and writer. What he learned from his work as a historian is that the right way to do history is by getting your hands dirty in an archive of ephemera and detritus. He has also taught me that this is the only way to do psychoanalysis, no less understand it. To this end, he is someone who knows something important about memory as an act of memorializing. Ben.
Uh, I'm not a Lacanian, but I'll be short. I first began flirting with psychoanalysis in college. It was Brown University. I thought she was French. We began going steady a little bit later. I played the field, you know, and tried to introduce myself to some others. But I couldn't stay away. We started going steady. It was 2005, January 2005, in fact. I tried to introduce her to my family, but it didn't take. And in 2007, I married psychoanalysis. And I've been married to psychoanalysis ever since, and had it up and downs. You know, I've ended up sleeping on the couch. But I love her, and I'm going to miss her. And in lieu of a proper eulogy, I just thought I'd show some keepsakes from our time together, things that I've collected and held on to, ephemera, as Dr. Webster said. So if we could please have the first slide. I have nothing funny to say. I can sit here in silence all day if you like.
Ben, do you have your flash drive there?
We could pass it back.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Screen memories. I could do it. It's from my head. I feel jealous that Patricia's slides worked out so well. How's it going back there? You know, I have to say, in my life as a professor, I actually fake mechanical difficulties all the time. It really makes the lectures much shorter. Psychoanalysis. Thanks for the memories. Next slide, please. Previous slide, please.
Oh, no.
Give away all my jokes, please. A printing block of Sigmund Freud's head, bought off eBay. Notice the nails. Next. Handbills for the very first collection of Freud's collected works in German. The missing volume 12 of Freud's collected works in German. My baby's first collected set of Freud's writings in English. Edward Gorey's years as an illustrator of Freud's books. Pop Art Freud, 1966. This happened to have folded into it a bill of sale William T. Golden. Founder of the National Science Foundation. That's just funny. It's actually Oxford University Press, in case you can't see it. Affectionately, Heinz and Rudy. Heinz Hartmann, right, the founder of ego psychology. And Rudolf Lowenstein, who was Lacan's analyst and Mary Bonaparte's lover. A book plate belonging to Greg Zilborg, great psychoanalyst, Gershwin, Lilia Hellman, and many, many others. The journals I got from Charles Brenner. He had them bound. You can find articles in them, like the International Journal of Psychoanalysis' great article, Le Planche en Pontelli, Fantasy and the Origins of Sexuality, an article known to us all. You can also find Charles Brenner's opinions of these articles. You can also find Charles Brenner's prescription slips stuck into these journals. Here's a tobacco card or a cigarette card or a chocolate card of Princess Marie Bonaparte, who I think is the unknown hero of psychoanalysis. And here is one of the greatest vanity publishing, I'm going to talk really fast, vanity publishing projects. Marie Bonaparte, who published her journals. All five in exact replicas so that we could learn all about her youth. Here's something that Dr. Webster and I worked on together and was published in Cabinet. This is the signature page of the copy of Anti-Oedipus that Deleuze gave to Foucault. He had his children, ages 10 and 8, draw pictures for Foucault. And then he had a look at the pictures and wrote the comments that you see on the left-hand side. No, Oedipus does not exist. I don't know, I just thought I'd include this. And three free sessions to anybody who comes to my office with this tattoo.
We're almost there, but we still have a funeral procession, lest I remind you. Simon Critchley has meditated on death perhaps more than anyone else. Every book he has written bears a relation to death, teaching us to live with death always in our mouths, that the fear of death is a denial of our freedom, and only through death can we hear what there is, simply, merely, very little, almost nothing. Tonight he will sing a requiem to the interpretation of dreams.
Brian DeWam on the accordion. Goodbye, Sigmund Freud. Although I never knew you at all, you had the grace to hold yourself while those around you crawl. They crawled out of the woodwork and they twist it into your brain. Put you on a treadmill. And they made you change your name. And it seems to me you lived your life like a candle in the wind, never knowing who to cling to when the rain set in. And I would have liked to know you, but I was just a kid. The candle burned out long before the legend ever did. Loneliness was tough, the toughest role you ever played. Hollywood created a superstar, and you paid for the price you paid. How was the next line? They held you on a treadmill. Oh, yeah. Do it again. Okay. Even when you died, oh, the press, they hounded you. All the papers had to say was that Zygmunt was found in the news. And it seemed to me you lived your life like a candle in the wind, never knowing who to cling to when the rain set in. And I would have liked to know you, but I was just a kid. The candle burned out long before the legend ever did. I'm gonna take it down now. Take it way down. Goodbye, Sigmund Freud. Although I never knew you at all, you had the grace to hold yourself while those around you crawled. Goodbye, Sigmund Freud, to a young man in the 22nd row who saw you as something more than sexual, more than just our Sigmund Freud. And it seems to me you lived your life like a candle in the wind, never knowing who to cling to when the rain set in. And I would have liked to know you, but I was just a kid. The candle burned out long before the legend ever did. The candle burned out long before the legend ever did. The candle burned out long, long, long before.
Listen, listen. How expensive.
Yeah.
You know, okay, that's a complicated issue. I mean, don't be the usual Marxist. You know, the problem is, of course, I mean, it has to cost some money because you have to invest in what you're doing. I mean, it has to have some cost. Otherwise, the whole setting, the transfer, everything, it doesn't work.
Sina. Air. Some air would be good. Everybody, we're gonna have a funeral procession. We're gonna take a short. I'm serious. We're gonna do it. You came. You dressed up. It's time to go for a little walk to the Gowanus Canal, where we will. Yes, we are going to bury psychoanalysis at the Gowanus. Put on your coats.